my friend, are you in retirement now? Is it does it feel like that? I mean, how is the last time we heard from you was, you know, last spring when you announced you weren't going to come back, and here you are. How are things in your life, in your world these days?
Well, Rob, they're different. This is usually a time of year when I'm really busy and 7 days a week and going here, there, and everywhere and preparing for this, preparing for that. And at times I do find time long in the transition stage that I'm going through here. But I'm still trying to keep, you know, a bit active on some things, but just certainly nowhere near as active as I had been in the past. So that's been an adjustment. There's no question about that. You know, I'm trying to keep busy as I can through all of this.
Tell me about, because you and I would often have conversations about rhythm, and I know that life being perfect for you was game, off day, game. What's your rhythms like, Pete? Is it difficult for your body to adjust?
Well, my sleeping patterns now are totally different. You know, I'm used to, you know, going to bed later at night and getting up, you know, fairly early in the morning and then starting to prepare for whatever was ahead for that particular day. Now I go to bed a little earlier and sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night and can't go back to sleep. And so so I'm trying to adjust that way. Sometimes I'll just get up and go and get online and do some things that way and do some creative things on my computer or whatever. So it's been definitely a whole different life. Now, having said that, it's just now that it's starting to get that way because I kind of planned the fall in a manner whereby I keep myself fairly busy, knowing that after, you know, it's been 50 years. If you go back to my time in when I started broadcasting in New Brunswick, it's been about 50 years since I haven't been involved with a hockey season and a working situation. So, October I played some golf and September as well. Here in Calgary, played in a few tournaments, and as you know, those things take up a good amount of time, 9-10 hours some days, and then went off to Phoenix and hung out down there for a little bit in the early part of the season, and just to, you know, keep myself busy golfing or cycling or whatever. So even at that, there were times when I found time long. But, you know, it's been an adjustment. There's no question about that. And you used to be going flat out, and all of a sudden, you know, gee, what are we going to do here for the next couple hours type thing? The two things that I really miss about the broadcasting, the games, is the camaraderie developed with all the people that you come in contact with locally and around the NHL. And the game itself, like I still haven't found a replacement for that rush that you get when you're up in the booth and the game is just about ready to start. And I don't know that I'll ever be able to find a replacement for that. So that maybe it's not necessary even to do that. But those are the two things that really stand out more than anything else.
Got to ask you about things that maybe most people don't know, but you were the best I've ever seen in preparation. Your preparation was second to none. I can only imagine now. You still have that reflex, right? You hear something, you go, you know, you probably have some great notes right now. There's an element to that, isn't there?
Well, thank you. And that's interesting because early on in the summer when the hockey season ended, of course, there were all kinds of player transactions via trades or player signings. When I'd hear about it, right away I'd get onto my computer, go to my hockey plan that I or format that I had there, and start getting into the process of moving the player from team A to team B. And then I'd get in the middle of that and I'd say, I don't have to do this. And then there'd be some bits of information I'd pick up, and it would be the same thing. If I wasn't near my computer, I'd write it down so that I'd take it with me and put into my database. So those are things that are not so much now. Although when I do come across something want to research something about something in particular that has to do with the Flames or the team, I'll go do it and write it down, make a note of it, even though it may not even get to anybody or anything. It just sort of for my own inclination, maybe more than anything else.
Do you find yourself yelling at televisions or radios or things like that, that when you hear things or you see things, that you react to things the way, you know what I mean? Is there an element of kind of still participating on the outside when the game's on?
No, I just sit there and very calmly watch the games and have no, you know, have no real, you know, overall emotion, if you will. I take it all in and sort of absorb the game, if you will. And you listen to the broadcasters, too, to sort of, you know, see how they're doing and that type of thing. Some of the little plans that they have. And, you know, because when you've been the broadcaster, I mean, I'm probably listening to the broadcast differently than the ordinary fan would now. And that's always been the case. So that continues to be there. But, no, I don't have any emotion one way or the other as these games go on. And whether I'm watching the Flames or whether I'm watching two other teams that are playing, I'm just taking it all in and trying to be a fan and not letting the emotions get there at all.
Pete, what's it like to meet the fans now? What's it like when they come up to you now?
It's been incredible, Rob. I never dreamed that I had this much impact in the city. The whole summer and even now, I mean, just about everywhere I go, I get people to come up to me and they'll say, thank you for providing the great service that you did as a broadcaster. And it just flabbergasted me. There'd be times before when, you might be in a convenience store or a gas station and you say something and then all of a sudden heads turn because, oh, geez, I know that voice. And then they'll say, are you Peter Marr? And, you know, that would happen a bit. Yeah. But now it happens so frequently. It's just been, I'm just overwhelmed by all of that. I mean, I know when I made the announcement, all of the texting and the emails and the phone calls and Twitter was going pretty wild there too for a while, and I was just couldn't believe that a little guy like me from a very small small town background had such an impact on people. And you know, I still haven't grasped it by any way, shape, or form, but I've certainly been pleased with all of the outpouring of comments that I've gotten from people and the thank yous. But to me, I thank them because, you know, without your listeners, we are really nothing in this game. And it doesn't matter whether you're a broadcaster, player, a coach, an owner, management, or whatever. If we don't have fans, we don't have anything. And I'm so pleased that I've been able to have such great support over all these years.
Was there a second surge, Pete? I mean, you had that outpouring when the announcement came. But when season begins and things get going again and you're not there, there must have been a recollection or a recognition by some that you aren't there, and there must have been more reaching out when the year began.
Yeah, there were a lot of people would come over, gee, we really miss you on there. And, you know, and it's understandable when you've done the broadcasting as long as I have, people become familiar with the voice that was calling the game. So it's understandable that the people would find it a difference. And I just always say, well, it's different for me too. I'm not there. And, you know, and they say, well, you know, you got a new guy there and he's not you. And I say, well, give Derek Wilson some time. He's just starting off. He's a rookie. He's in a whole new league. He's with a whole new team. He's around a whole bunch of new people, new fans, everything. So, you know, this is the message that I pass along to the people, is I give this guy some time, and eventually he'll cultivate a fandom here, and it'll just, you know, it'll just mushroom on from there. So, but, you know, I get that, you know, quite a bit here in the early going of the season.
50 years ago, eh? 50 years ago, it started?
Yeah.
I mean, does it...
It's about 50 years ago.
Does it feel like that?
No. it doesn't feel like that at all. Like, it almost feels like it was yesterday that I started.
Yeah.
I just go back and remember that day that Doug Young said to me, he was a radio station manager in my hometown in Campbellton, New Brunswick, we want to put you on the air. I'm looking at him kind of like, what? And, you know, so, and it doesn't seem that long. I mean, it's that old thing that is when you're having fun, time goes fast. And it goes really too fast. And you know, you look back and you say, well, no, that wasn't that long. But then you do the math, and sure enough, it was that long. So it is really has really gone by quickly over that time. So, you know, when other people are doing things that they enjoy, yeah. you tell them, you know, to really, really grasp it and you know, run with it for all it's worth because it goes fast.
You were really young, though, when you were tagged, right? Like, you weren't even out of high school, were you?
I was in high school. Where it began is that I was doing the public address announcing in a softball league in my hometown, and one of the players was the manager of the station, Doug, and he came to me one day and he said, well, would you mind phoning in reports from the game? So I started doing that, and then in my last year of high school, he says, we want you to be our sports guy. So I'd go in the morning and do the morning sports. Then I'd go to school, and then I'd come back and do the afternoon sports. And, you know, I'd meet people on the street then, and they'd say, you're Peter Marr? Because I guess my voice was really well developed then, and they'd say, geez, this little young guy on the air. They didn't realize that a guy could be that young and have such a powerful voice as I had. So that's where it started. And then, you know, eventually it led into doing play-by-play of the team, Campbellton Tigers back home, and the team down the road, Dalhousie Rangers. I mean, that's where I developed my broadcast style, is that for 8 years, I would broadcast for two teams, the same league, separated by 15 miles. And so, you know, I was very, very conscious of broadcasting the game with a fair balance for the audience to listen to. And even though, you know, I'd get people from the neighboring town saying, oh, no, talking about, he doesn't care about us. But that, you know, you understand that's the way that it goes. Mm-hmm. And what was real interesting is that when I started in Toronto, when I went from Campbellton to Toronto, when I think back at that, it's so surreal.
Yeah.
Going from a town of 7,000 to a city of 7 million, just like that. Before I broadcast my first Maple Leaf game, I had the opportunity meeting Harold Ballard, who was the owner of the team then. And I asked him, I said, do you have any advice? And his comment to me was, remember, there's two teams on the ice. And that's always stuck with me. And I, you know, I could think when Harold Ballard, who was such a bombastic guy, would give you advice like that. You know, it was interesting with Harold, is that, you know, after I got started and so on, I got to know him quite well, and he was a different guy when you sit down and have a one-on-one conversation, as opposed to when you got a microphone on and a whole bunch of media people around, when he'd be, you know, completely showtime.
I don't think I've ever asked you this question, Pete, and I've always made the assumption, but I should ask. You're self-taught? I mean, when you go to, you know, in high school, you go and start reading morning sports.
Well, I had good guidance from Doug at that time, okay. Doug Young, talked about. And he was, you know, and some of the other guys at the radio station there were very helpful as well. I guess perhaps in the early going, I kind of was self-taught. And I'd spend a lot of time listening to ball games and in the summer. Like down there, you could get the Red Sox games and the Yankee games, and then the hockey season, you could get the Canadians and the Maple Leafs. So I spent a lot of time listening to that and try to formulate things from there. And then when I started at the NHL level, got a lot of guidance from the people at the CKO network, Ralph Mellenby, who was then with Hockey Night in Canada, and a few other folks that were there. They were very helpful in pointing some things out to me that, that were very, very helpful in my early going, things that I hadn't really, had within my arsenal before I went there. So, I would say a lot of it was self-taught, but I had a lot of good guidance along the way, too.
Well, and there was a time where you kind of came in towards the end of Foster Hewitt's, and not influence, he was still there. His influence has long been felt, but you were part of that generation, right, that was influenced by Foster.
Yes, yeah. I mean, Foster Hewitt and Danny Gallivan were the two broadcasters that I listened to from a hockey standpoint as a youngster. I mean, they were on television, and they were on radio, too, at that time. And, so those were my two idols. And, later Bob Cole would come into the mix. But, I had the pleasure of meeting Danny. It's an interesting story. with Danny that in the summer before I went to Toronto, I'll back up a little bit. Earlier on that year, a friend of mine who was a bank manager in my hometown said to me, he said, you know, you're too good a broadcaster for this town. You shouldn't be here. You should be somewhere else. And so I said, my comment to him was, well, if, you know, if I'm good, they'll find me. And he said to me, no, be proactive. And so I sent tapes, had tape recordings in those days, to Danny Gallivan and to Ralph Mellenby. And anyways, then that year, Danny came and spoke at a minor hockey banquet in my hometown. And while he was in his speech, he said to the audience, there's a guy in this room and a guy that you all know well who's not going to be here much longer because he's too good a hockey broadcaster to be here. And he mentioned my name and so on and so forth. And 3 months later, I was gone to Toronto.
But what did that mean to you, Pete? To have a guy that you looked up to, a guy that you had reached out to come to your hometown and tell your people you weren't going to be there much longer. What did that mean to you?
Well, I mean, you know, I was just shocked when he mentioned it. I was in the audience. I'm like, whoa, you know, what's he, you know, and of course, they got a little bit of applause and so on and so forth. But to think that he listened to one of my broadcasts and felt strong enough about it to tell an audience that I was, you know, going to be moving away because I was good enough to be into another level of broadcasting was really flattering to hear that, and a big boost to my confidence as well. And so, you know, I don't know that even at that point that Danny thought it was going to happen 3 months later, but it did. And I look back on that season, mm-hmm. when I really felt I was an NHL broadcaster was the first time the Maple Leafs went into the Montreal Forum. And Danny was in his booth, and I was in the booth next to him. Mm-hmm. And I'm right next door to my idol, and we're both broadcasting the same game. By that time, I'd already broadcast about 15 or 16 games as it was released. But so, that was really something. And to this day, the last time I saw Danny was the day that Lanny McDonald was got the nomination to be inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame. Yeah. It was in Montreal at the annual meetings of the league, where there's different than it is now, and they had the draft there, and the Hall of Fame committee had a meeting, and Danny was on the selection committee, and he came out of that meeting, and I chatted with him just briefly, and he said to me, or I said to him, well, let's get together later. And then, of course, he told me that Lanny was... they were going to make the announcement that Lanny was in the Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, maybe we might not be able to do that today. I mean, now it looks like I'm going to be real busy here. So that was the last time I talked to him. And it was that season that he passed away rather, very suddenly. And, I'll never forget that. And I know that night that I broadcast the Flame game, that night that he died, I broadcast a game that night. And in my opening, I dedicated the broadcast to Danny. And I was so overcome with emotion with that I didn't have a very good broadcast. Yeah. And I really felt badly after the game and that sort of thing, because I had, you know, dedicated this one to him, and I didn't feel I was as good as I should have been.
Do you realize how impactful what Danny said to that group of people at that dinner was to you? Because I don't know if you know this, but it clearly influenced you and shaping the person you are and became, because you did the exact same thing for me when I got here in 2004, it was the 2003 season, but in 2004, we were at a luncheon, and you did the exact same thing for me, and I heard you do the exact same thing for Derek Wills when Derek got here.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is amazing to hear you tell that story, because I've seen you do that, and clearly that influenced you.
Yeah, that was a big influence, and also my parents were a big influence on me, instilling in me the importance of recognizing other people for their talents and all that sort of thing, and not being about yourself. Mm. And it's just something, I guess, that was ingrained with me from the beginning. And of course, having Danny being the same way, just sort of reinforced, yeah, that's the right way to do business.
Yeah.
And conduct yourself and carry yourself. And I've always been positive in trying to pass along help to other people in the business, and I'm always open to them if they have them with questions and that sort of thing. And it just goes back to my roots.
Well, if you didn't say it, I would have said it for you, because it's absolutely true. You always have been that way. You talked a little bit about learning the broadcasting and the influence there. And I mentioned it before, I've always been absolutely just totally in awe of your preparation. How did you learn, and I'm assuming preparation for you evolved, technology evolved, the information evolved, and the access to it. But, Pete, your ability to recall, your ability to find information, dates, times, and things like that, where did the preparation get influenced from? Where did that come from?
That was something that even right from when I was a kid, I would be, I'd read newspapers all the time. There was no internet, obviously, in those days. It was a long way from being invented. I'd read constantly. I'd read the hockey news. I'd read Sports Illustrated. There'd be information there that I'd pick off and make note of it, or, it would get registered up on in my brain or whatever. It was all right from the beginning. I remember my mother said to me one day, and of course, we'd play table hockey, or we'd play hockey in the backyard, and I'd do a play-by-play. And my mother said to me, "You're going to be a hockey broadcaster." And that was I was probably only 10 or 12 years old at that time. But it was ingrained in me right from the beginning. I think it was just something I was born with, to be prepared and constantly looking for an edge, if I'll call it, and that's what I call trying to get various pieces of information. Well, it's an edge. Something you tell people that maybe they didn't know. And I, took a lot of pride in trying to pass that information along and try to find little things. It's one thing to say so-and-so has 5 goals and 6 assists. It's another thing to break it down in another manner. And those were things that I really worked hard at wanting to have it and pass it along to the audience.
You said something there about context has always been a strength, too. It's one thing. We can throw numbers at people, but unless there's context to it, they really don't mean anything.
Yes, that's right. Exactly. Exactly right. Yeah. So that's what I tried to, get another layer in there to pass on to the people. It was interesting when I started. Everything I would do for my notes was all handwritten. Mm-hmm. And I would have a sheet with the handwritten names of the players and notes there. I remember one day, old Lefty Reed, who used to be the curator of the Hockey Hall of Fame, it was in Toronto, he came by our broadcast booth one night, and he looked at it and said, "Did you do that yourself?" And I said, "Yeah, it was all small print." And he said, "How long did it take you to do that?" It's all a while, but, it's all here and I'm ready for the game. And he said, "Give me that sheet someday. We'll take it to the Hall of Fame." So I gave it to him when I don't know what he ever did with it. But anyhow, having him say that reinforced what I was doing, all that extra time you were putting in to prepare. It made it worthwhile having somebody recognize that you'd put the time in to do that. And then, you'd talk to Pete, you'd pass some information out on a broadcast. I mean, "Gee, I heard you say that. I didn't know that." Or, those were all things that reinforce what you're doing. Now, as in the course of a game, hockey, it's a fast game. You can usually about 90% of what you're prepared for, you don't get into the broadcast, but you always have to have it, because you just never know what the game is going to be like and what situation is going to develop through the course of it.
The 10% rule.
The 10% rule, right, exactly.
For the benefit of our listeners, you want to explain that, Pete? Because it's funny, our mutual friend, our good friend Mark Stiles, I remember talking to Mark when he was the voice of the Calgary Hitmen and I was in Saskatchewan in the Junior League, and Mark said, we're talking about prep, he says, 10% rule. Peter Meyer taught me the 10% rule, and your influence already began to affect me then, but just talk about the 10% rule.
Well, as they said, the game is, it's a fast-moving game, the game of hockey, and you need to be prepared for any eventuality when you go into the game, but you realize in your own mind that only about 10% of that is going to get on the air. But if you don't have everything, then you're not totally prepared for the game, even though 90% of what you've done is not going to get on on that given night. Somebody could carry over to another night, but you just don't know what's going to develop through the course of a game. You've got to have that information there so there's something develops that's, pertinent to what you have there. You can bring it in to reinforce what is happening. And then, of course, if you get into a situation where a game has a delay, then you've got it all there. But if you can get 10% of what you have prepared for on a given night, You've done a good job. And, the audience, they don't, they won't realize you have so much other stuff there. But it's, I get some people come to me and they'll see my notes and they'll say, oh, I didn't realize you did all that. I mean, it was almost the feeling of some fans that you show up for the game and you do the broadcast and that's it. Yeah. But, there's a lot more. There's more preparation than there actually is time on the air. And that's all part of what it's all about to be a success.
One last one on this topic. How do you describe your style, Pete?
I describe my style as being a broadcaster that paints a picture, brings excitement to the game, passes along information that perhaps an audience, a listener, wouldn't know, and also being a fair broadcaster. And it goes back to what Mr. Ballard said to me: remember, there's two teams on the ice. And so those are the things that I strive to bring to a broadcast each and every night that I step into the booth.
You and I have had many philosophical conversations about the game in terms of the information, what is public domain, what isn't. This age of insiders, Pete, you kind of grew up in it, now the rumors and things like that. Can you just talk about how that has changed and kind of how you dealt with, because you saw a lot of things. You were the keeper of some, I don't want to call them secrets because that sounds like we're hiding something, but you know what I'm talking about. Some was for public, some wasn't for public air.
Well, it's a matter of trust. I mean, I'd get information from somebody and maybe it was the Flames, maybe it's another team in the league, but it would be with the notation, now this is not to be made public, and this is just for your information type thing. And it got frustrating to me as time went on and all the social media came in, because I had known some information, but I was told to say nothing. And next thing you know, it pops up somewhere, and you say, darn, somebody else got this, and I really had it before anybody else. I'll give an example. When the Flames traded Steve Montador, had played a game in Detroit the night before the trade, and I'm sitting after the game with Daryl Sutter. And Daryl was the general manager, coach of the Flames. And so Daryl says, well, tomorrow we're making this trade. So he tells me the details. Now he said, we'll let you know when you can announce it. So I said, fine. So then I go the next morning, get up, and I do my my Mar in the Morning hit and don't mention anything about it. Well, I'm off the air, say, 10, 15 minutes, and all of a sudden I'm getting a phone call from the radio station. So-and-so is saying the Flames have traded Steve Montador or so. And yes, you can run with it. So, but you sit there, okay, I held, but what happens sometimes is that people will tell you this information in trust, and they'll say, as Daryl did, we'll let you know. Then they get busy and forget to tell you ahead of time when you can announce it. So it gets frustrating that way. I had some incidents like that with other Cliff Fletcher when he was general manager of the Flames, Al Coates, and so on and so forth. But it's frustrating. But nonetheless, that's all part of the business, that you have to earn the trust of the people that they're dealing with. And I did that. And at times you get beat on a story, but that's the way it goes. I remember Don Armstrong, who was the guy who was my boss when when I worked for Rolco Communications broadcasting Flame games. And when I'd get something like that would happen, he'd say, well, Peter, it's not important to be first. It's important to cover it best after it happens. And, that's kind of been a philosophy that kind of helps me get through the frustration of getting beat on a story when I already knew about it. But that's, the way this modern media and social media has developed, and how it's changed over all these years and made it difficult for a guy who started out in another type of routine.
Peter, tell me about coming to Calgary. The first time you contemplated a move here, coming here for work, what was going through your mind?
Well, it was an interesting situation that had developed in Toronto after I broadcast the Leafs games there for three seasons. The radio station that had gained the broadcast rights, purchased the broadcast rights from Foster Hewitt's radio station, one of my boyhood idols, they had the rights, and after the 79-80 season, they decided they were losing money. The company was in financial trouble. They were ahead of their time. It was an all-news station. And, you know, now there's all news stations. They're very popular and so on. But at those days for Canada, it was very new, and they were really big. They'd got right across Canada. They had stations in all the major cities. So anyway, they told me, said, look, we're not going to be renewing the rights, and they're probably going to go back to Foster Station. Well, Foster still had his people there, his sons and so on, so there was going to be no position for me there. And then, of course, that was when the Flames were in the process of making the move from Atlanta to Calgary. Now, the years that I broadcast the Leaf games, they were aired in Calgary on the CKO station on the network in Calgary, because there wasn't an NHL team here then. So when, you know, I was told they were going to have the rights, I'm sitting there thinking, geez, this could be the end of my career. I may be going back to Campbellton tomorrow, broadcasting the Campbellton Tigers. And so anyway, you know, the situation developed about Calgary, and so I came out here and I chatted with the folks and then went back, and then they said, well, we'd like to have you come to Calgary, offer me the job. And so I said, sure, might as well go and see how it is and take it from there. And now 35 years later, I'm still here.
Did you step off a plane or did you drive out here? I mean, a kid from the East Coast shows up at the foot of the Rocky Mountains. It must have been a little culture shock.
Well, I came out, I flew out first for an interview. So I got that cultural shock early.
Yeah.
But no, I drove when I came out to start work. I did drive from Toronto to Calgary, and that is the only time that I've driven that road, because I've never gone back by car driving. I've always flown ever since that. That drive was a long, long drive. I've never driven again. And it's interesting, Doug Gilmore was a player here with the Flames. And so I think after his first year or second year, I forget, but he decides he's going to drive back from Calgary to Toronto or Kingston, Ontario as well. And he started off, and he got halfway through, and he said, I'm never doing this again. And he relayed that story to me later, and so I relayed the story to him too. I said, yeah, well, when I came out, that's the only time that I drove. Every time after that, it's been flying. So it was, you know, when you go through the prairie, when you're driving, if mm-hmm. you're on a plane, unless you can see, you know, you don't really get the impact of prairie, and then all of a sudden these mountains arrive. And at that time, you know, the outskirts of Calgary weren't like they are today, developed with housing and shopping malls and arenas and all that stuff. I mean, it was pretty barren when you were coming in from the east. So it was quite a shocker to drive in and see, whoa, you're on flat land and all of a sudden you see these mountains. So it was quite a shock. Not as big a shock though as going from Campbellton to Toronto, from a standpoint of culture and emotions and all of that stuff. I mean, that was something, going from such a small town and right into this thriving, big, sprawling metropolis of Toronto.
Was the beginning, was it smooth? Was the transition easy? I mean, I've never heard you talk of it being rocky, but taking over and becoming the voice of the Calgary Flames, was it an easy transition for you to make?
It was hockey. It was, you know, I had the Leafs, and the Leafs were always my team as a kid. So, you know, I dreamed of being their goalie and then came to be their play-by-play guy. So it took a little bit of an adjustment that way to transition from being the Maple Leafs broadcaster to the Flames broadcaster. So there was a little bit of intrepidness in the beginning, but that didn't take long to adjust. And, of course, broadcasting in the corral, I mean, you were practically on the ice doing the game. So, I mean, it was really a difference from being so far from the ice, as was the case when you were at Maple Leaf Gardens and most of the other buildings in the NHL. So broadcasting those early years in the corral, I mean, that was really something. I mean, you could almost feel the hits up there when they were made by the players and the intensity. And that's the one thing, just to get off a little bit of another subject, as a broadcaster, that's the one thing that I wish all of the broadcasters could do is have a better broadcast location than they have. I always feel like the Corral was the exception. I mean, you were right on the ice almost. But I always felt that the best broadcast location would be in the front row of the second level and right in the middle of the ice. And, of course, in all these modern buildings that are being built, you're 100 miles from the ice, it seems, as opposed to what I call the ideal location. The last ideal location we had was in San Jose, in the Sharks building there, the Shark Tank, as they called it. I mean, it was right at the spot that I talked about, the first, the first row center ice of the second level. You were right there. You were close enough that you could feel the game, you know, the intensity and the speed. And, you know, when you're up in the high levels that the broadcast from now, you don't feel the intensity of the game and you don't get the speed. I remember one day after a Flame game, I spoke at a Rotary Club meeting, and there was a question answer period after, and one guy said, "Yeah, I went to the game last night. Gee, that was a boring game." And before I could answer, another guy jumped up and he said, "Are you crazy? That was a heck of a game." And so I said, "Okay," to the guy who thought it was a heck of a game, I said, "Where did you sit?" And he said, "Well, I was sitting in the lower bowl." I asked the other guy, "Where did you sit?" He said, "Well, I was up top." I said, "Okay, that's the difference, is that the closer you are to the game, it's faster and you get the intensity. The further away, it's a slower game." And so, I mean, not very often did you get the ideal broadcast locations when you're broadcasting out of an NHL building. And as years gone by, you know, it got worse. I mean, yeah. Broadcasting in the Boston Garden and the Montreal Forum, the Chicago Stadium, they're a lot different from the buildings they have in those cities now when it comes to a broadcast location. So, unfortunately, the location that I talk about would also be a prime seating area for fans. And the dollar they derived from that was more important than appeasing we broadcasters.
Let's talk. I mean, there's so many different directions we could go, Pete, and I could keep you all day. So I do want to sharpen the focus a little bit here on you. Tell me about working with Doug Barkley.
Doug was a great, great guy to work with. And what was interesting with Doug is that he had one eye. I mean, I'm told by people that, you know, saw him play when he was in junior and he started in the NHL and also in the minor leagues, that he was going to be a superstar player in the league as a defenseman. And then he lost his eye I think he was 24 years old when he lost his eye and was just getting into his stride. And I often, with Doug, he would see more with that one eye, as a color commentator, than I and most people would with two. And because he would pick out stuff that was so innate out there, but he had a great knowledge of the game. He'd been a player, he'd been a coach in the NHL, and he was Doug was a guy that wasn't big on getting information on the players, what year they were drafted, and where they played their junior hockey, and all that stuff. But he really knew the game of hockey, and he the coaches that the Flames had, he always had a great relationship with them, and they'd share insights with him that most media people wouldn't be able to get, and he would be able to decipher what he could use and what he couldn't, and did an excellent job that way. But, Doug, and another side of it, too, we had a lot of fun. In those days, the Battle of Alberta was in its total prime, and Rod Phillips was the broadcaster for the Oilers, and he had Brown.
Yes.
I'm trying to think of his first name. Ken Brown was the color man. So Rod and I'd have a little chat. Well, if there's a fight tonight, I like my guy better than your guy. You look after me. So, and things like that. And Doug was a rough guy, when he played the game. And at times he could be that way away from the game as well. So a lot of fun in the 20 years that I worked with Doug.
I'm obviously very partial to the guy I want to ask you about. But tell me about working with Mike Rogers.
Oh, Mike was almost a total different from Doug. He had two eyes, but
there is that, yeah.
But very conscientious on being prepared, getting all the background information on players and working in. And he too had a tremendous insight to the game of hockey. Mike and I often joked over a beer or whatever. You'd have made a good coach in the NHL. And Mike had laughed. No, I'm too soft. Mm. I said, no, I'm just for your insight to the game and that type of thing. But Mike and I worked together for 12 years as the play-by-play and a color guy, and not only were we, it was the same with Doug, not only were we not only were we colleagues on the air, but we're also great friends off the ice. And, you know, Mike was a guy that you could share a lot of information with. Like, he'd come, what do you think of that, blah, blah, blah. And Mike was really, really good at giving you his opinion. And on air, he, you know, sometimes he softened a little bit, but he had some very strong opinions of the way players were playing or mm-hmm. the team was playing or all that sort of thing. But Mike was, you know, he was a complete opposite from Doug. So it took a little while to adjust to Mike and his style and all of the things there. But, I mean, without those two guys, I don't know that I'd have been around the league as long as I was. They made my job so much easier with the knowledge that they had of the game and things that they could pick out. And without that, you know, I may be lost some nights, but they would, yeah, okay, we got that. You know, they'd see some things that you wouldn't notice yourself and pass that along and point out little things. It's just so much little intricate things that those guys had that made my job easier.
And you got 1 year with our good friend Mr. Lavardius, which must have been a little different working with another play-by-play guy in the booth.
Yeah, that was really a difference, and took a little bit to get used to it. And not only was it another guy that was a play-by-play mm-hmm. guy, but Peter, you know, for the years leading up to his assignment as the color commentator, was on television. And as you know, Rob, it's different, yep. Radio and television, when you're doing a broadcast. Like, you know, I had to remind Peter a few times in the early going that when the play starts, you got to stop talking and the play-by-play guy comes in. Because on television, you can talk while the play is going on because the audience can see the game. Whereby when you're on the radio, the fans can't see the game. And, you know, if the color commentator or the play-by-play guy are talking back and forth, well, all of a sudden they hear a cheer in the background. The fans are saying, what happened? And we're talking about, you know, something else. So, Peter, you know, had that TV background, so it took a little bit of adjusting for him, and also adjusting the fact he was a color commentator and not a play-by-play guy. So it was an early transition that we were able to make quite quickly, and working with Peter was a thrill as well. There's one thing about Peter. He knew everything about every player that was out on the ice with regard to their background, and he had some pretty good insights as to what was happening down on the ice as well.
I want to ask you about Ed Whalen, because clearly this city was blessed at one point to have two iconic broadcasters, one in TV and one in radio at the same time. What was it like working, you know, alongside or in, you know, concert, however you want to say, with the great Ed Whalen?
The thing I remember most about Ed was going out to dinner and him telling wrestling stories. Because he had that background with wrestling with the Hart family and all of those other guys. And I mean, those stories he would tell about those trips that they'd go on and with these wrestlers and all that, I mean, it was priceless. I mean, he was also a good mentor as well. Mm-hmm. But that's the one that really sticks out from my time around Ed Whalen, that I had the opportunity to do that for about 15 or 16 years. But he also had some pretty good things to pass along with regard to the business. Kid, he'd say, kid, you know, remember this kid, remember that kid, and that type of deal. And, you know, there's another guy. The last time I saw him was at the back door of the Saddle Dome, where we come in, the media, mm-hmm. and where the players come in, and where the Zamboni goes on the ice. It was near the end of, or was at the end of the Flame season. It was green garbage bag day, if you will. And Eddie had retired by then, but he was down there. And so he was telling me about, we were having a good chat, and he was telling me about going to Florida and then going on this cruise. And anyway, he had the cruise, and then he got back to Florida, and unfortunately had a massive heart attack and passed away. So I didn't get to see him anymore after that. So, you know, you really miss being around Eddie. I mean, the things that he could tell you about the business and the stories of other wrestlers, I mean, those were absolutely, absolutely incredible. And, you know, he had the way he talked and the phrases that he had. I mean, those are things that were absolutely awesome that still stick out.
We could go on forever, yeah. Pete. Let me ask you just a couple quick ones. One, when you close your eyes at night, what's the Flames memory that stands out for you?
The Flame memory that stands out and always will be May 25th, 1989, a Thursday night, Montreal Forum, and the siren going and the Flames winning the Stanley Cup. That is, you know, there have been other ones that are, you know, pretty close, mm-hmm. but the Stanley Cup, victory against the Canadians that night stands out as the highlight. I mean, I could, it's as though it happened yesterday. I can just see the things that were happening. I can see Lanny's goal. I can see Colin Patterson's goal in the first period to start it off. And then the two Doug Gilmore got in the third period to clinch the game. I mean, that game is indelible in my mind. And that is, that I'm really, really pleased that I had the honor and privilege of broadcasting the Flames winning that Stanley Cup. And wish I would have had more Stanley Cups to have told the fans in Calgary about. But the fact that there was one is one more than a lot of people had the opportunity of broadcasting in this business. You know, you go back, there's guys that have been in the NHL and are still there, they've been there longer than me, still haven't broadcast a Stanley Cup winner. So that'll always be the greatest moment in my mind, the Calgary Flames.
Tell me about your family. I know you talked about them at your retirement, but you were very emotional about it, Pete. They've been there for you.
They've sacrificed a lot for me. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I get people come to me now and they say, did you go to the Flames game? Are you going to the Flames game tonight? And no, and they'll kind of look at me and go, well, why wouldn't you? Well, I said, first of all, he said, hockey's no longer my number one priority. Family is now comes first. When I get asked to have a speaking engagement or something, the first thing I do is I check with my son and my daughter to find out if the grandkids or they have anything that are going on that particular night. Right. And if they do, then I turn down the opportunity to go speak or whatever. And, you might find that hard to believe that after all of this time of being at hockey games that, no, it's not my number one priority anymore. The family had to put up with the fact that they were number two for a long, long time in many instances. The fact that, the game days, hockey would be my focus. And it would be the traveling where you're away half of the winter, so you're not around there. And when I look back on it, about the only regret I have of my career is that I missed a number of things that my kids did that I couldn't be there for, to share in the moment. I guess the one that stands out most is my son Jeff, when his team Calgary Buffaloes won the Air Canada Cup as Canadian Major Champions in Newfoundland. I couldn't be there for that because the Flames were in the playoffs. Surprise, surprise. And then my daughter had some singing things that she gained some pretty high accolades for, and I missed out on that. So I mean, it's all part of the price you pay to do something that you love. But my family's put up with me, my focus on game days and other days and then being away. Now it's their time.
Final question for you. What does this mean tonight? What will it mean to step out on the ice at the Dome? What will it mean to be saluted by the fans for you?
Well, I'm not really sure. I got, the way that I look at it is that this is my way of telling the fans, thank you for the support and their listeners. And, the people that are in the building are representing the fans from back in 1980 that listened. And some of them, of course, are no longer with us. But without those, as I've talked many times, without the fans, we're really nothing. And so this, to me, is the primary thing that I have in my mind is thanking the fans. Being out on the ice is going to be really strange. it's the first time I'm going to be at a Flame game and on the ice instead of high above the ice, getting set to get the game broadcast started.
So, second time.
Yes, that's true. Yes, you're right. You're right. I had forgotten
for a moment. Trust me, I will never forget that.
Yes, you are absolutely right. The night that I came back after the Hall of Fame honoring that he had in 2006, they asked me to drop the puck with the late Harley Hotchkiss, who was also honored at the Hockey Hall of Fame that same year. We co-dropped the puck. So I was at center ice when the game started, and you were behind the broadcast microphone.
Greatest moment of my life.
And you got it all. You got a goal. You got a fight.
I got it all.
While I
man.
Was making my way upstairs. How could I forget?
Look, you're going to say thank you to the fans tonight. I just want to take this opportunity on behalf of everybody that ever worked with you, man. You changed this. You were a great mentor. You were a great leader. All of those things, Pete. I don't know what to say, pal, other than it was a hell of an honor to be beside you for all these years. Please, enjoy tonight. We really want you to enjoy tonight.
Well, I'm going to enjoy it because, as I say, the chance for me to say thanks to the fans. My family's going to be there with me. My brothers and sisters are here. My buddies from New Brunswick are here, plus all my buddies here in Calgary. And it's going to be a night that's certainly going to be emotional. And I want to thank you for all of the help you've been to me since you came to Calgary and became part of the Flame broadcast and all the times that we have spent together. You're an excellent broadcaster, and you are very thorough in your work. And I thank you for my opportunity to get on here and thank the fans for what they did in my career.